Accession number 4410, reel number 3.
Sir John Glove, reel 3.
The following year, these raiders insisted on raiding Iraq and Transjordan, actually. And they then rebelled against Ibn Saud himself. So there was a civil war in Saudi Arabia, and eventually Ibn Saud defeated them. And ironically enough, the people who'd been raiding us arrived at the Iraqi frontier seeking to take refuge in Iraq from punitive measures by Ibn Saud. But fortunately, and quite rightly, the Iraq government and the British government refused to give them refuge from Ibn Saud, because after all we'd been protesting that he allowed them to raid us. And so Ibn Saud mopped them up within sight of my camp. Tremendous battle between Ibn Saud and his own subjects. And we subsequently, the British government, I must say, were very anxious to make peace between everybody. They didn't want to get involved in any of this stuff. And they arranged for a meeting between Abdulaziz ibn Saud and King Faisal I of Iraq. Neither king would visit the other, because they thought that would be put them in a rather inferior position. So a sloop of the British Navy appeared in the Persian Gulf, and the two monarchs went off in their respective ships and met on the middle of the deck on a British sloop. Anyhow, this was a formal meeting, but afterwards peace was made and has never since been broken. So that was another good thing, I think.
Coming back to the intelligence system which you arranged, you said that it partly involved planting spies. How did you discover that there was a Wahhabi spy amongst you?
Only afterwards. After peace and so on, you see, people were going backwards and forwards. And people came over to us and said, oh, you know what happened on that night? Why, it was so-and-so. He'd been in your camp the day before, and he came and told the raiders and so on. And when peace was made, everybody discussed what had happened.
You said that your job was made unpleasant by these politicians trying to influence you. What form did that take? Were they trying to give you bribes?
No, nobody ever tried to bribe a British officer. That was one thing in those days which was universally known. British officers never take money. No, it was... What happened was that we were in a rural district consisting of tribes with their chiefs. The political parties were anxious to secure the adherence of these chiefs to their parties. I was an inspector only, which is not an executive position. There was a governor, an Iraqi governor of the district. And the politicians in Baghdad used to write to this governor and say, such and such a sheikh says that he will give his support to the national party or whatever it is. Can you arrange for him to have lighter taxation? Or he's got a land dispute with somebody else. Can you please arrange for him to win? Because if he does, he says he'll join our party. Well, I was very keen on this administration as an art of administering. And these kind of interventions in the interest of political parties were absolutely maddening. The Iraqi governor of the district with whom I worked periodically felt himself obliged to pull a few strings. And I would have to go to him and say, look, you know perfectly well it isn't really right for this man to get let off paying his taxes. And he would say, yes, I know, you see, but after all, I got this job through so-and-so, the Minister of the Interior, and he wants this man helped. So I don't know what I can do, you see. It's very unfortunate. I wish I wasn't here, and so on. I wish they wouldn't ask me to pull strings. But this went on the whole time, and I find it extremely distressing.
Did you ever feel like resigning because of this?
I don't know that I went as far as that. You see, I'd burnt my boats because it was an insane thing to do from my own point of view, because I had a regular commission in the army. I gave that up on a contract with the Iraq government. This was lunacy. Because there was a treaty between Britain and Iraq which was due to expire in 1928. The Iraqi government was already saying, when the treaty expires, we shall reduce our British staff. So I'd really signed a worthless treaty with them, a worthless contract with them. When 1929, the new treaty was made by which Iraq was to be entirely independent and a member of the League of Nations. So everybody said to me, look here, you'll get the sack as soon as this treaty is enforced. So I'd given up my army commission for a piece of paper which is worthless.
You must have cursed yourself at times for having made...
Well, I say this was an intervention of Providence, because it so happened that in 1929 there was raiding in the middle of the Syrian desert. Well, I had this little party of 100 police, desert police, in vehicles armed with machine guns, which were to put an end to raiding. As soon as we made our peace with Ibn Saud, I took this bunch up further north to the borders of Syria to handle this local piece of fighting between tribes up there. And in the course of doing so, I discovered that a tribe from Transjordan had raided some sheep from an Iraqi tribe, because in winter all the tribes move out into the middle of the desert and mingle together. Some others, no water, they go back to the Euphrates or to whatever it is. So I signaled Baghdad and said, may I go over to Transjordan and recover the sheep which the Transjordanians have raided from Iraqis? So they said, yes, all right. I went over to Amman, recovered the sheep. I went with my little circus of machine gun police, you see, and came back, and that was that. I came back to Iraq. But the Transjordan government hadn't prevented raiding. They hadn't yet administered their deserts. And seeing my little circus, quite unknown to me, they got together with each other and said, we ought to have a thing like this, you see, and then we can stop raiding. So a short time after I got back to Iraq, I got a letter from the Transjordan government asking me if I'd like a contract with them to put an end to raiding in the Transjordan deserts. This just came when my contract with Iraq was about to be terminated. So I took a contract from the Transjordan government and went over to Amman. So I went over to Transjordan. Alone, of course. I mean, so I had to leave my desert police because they were in the service of the Iraq government. So when I arrived in Transjordan, the government said to me, well, we want you to stop raiding in our deserts too. What do you want? So the only thing in my mind was the little circus I'd had in Iraq. So I said to them, well, I want 100 men, Ford trucks and machine guns. So eventually I got sanctioned for this. But then I hadn't got any men, so I had to recruit them. So, as I always did, I just got into a car and drove out to the tribes in question, the raiders. And, of course, as usual, this is the great help you got in those days, that as a guest, they greeted you and accommodated you at once. And when I arrived there, I got talking and said, what's all this about raiding? Well, I found they had a very good grouse too, because it's true that they raided, but the Ibn Saud's tribes were much stronger and were supported by their government, whereas our tribes were obstructed by our government. And so they were really fighting the Saudi government and their own Transjordan government at the same time. So it was comparatively easy to prove to them that they couldn't possibly fight two governments, and they were getting the worst of it. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, I said the best thing to do is to stop this, and I tell you what I'll do. I'll recruit 100 men from you, so that you will get a good government pay. And if you stop raiding, you can breed your own flocks. But now you're losing because the Saudis are raiding from you more than you raid back from them. So eventually, it took rather a long time, because in early days, the tribes regarded all governments as their hereditary enemies, so to speak. And the idea of enlisting and serving under the government would be a frightful treachery to your tribe. See? However, fortunately, one or two men who'd been in my armed police in Iraq resigned from there, came over to Transjordan to come to me. And these were Bedouins, like all the other tribes, you see. So they helped me a lot. Although I spoke for the Transjordan Bedouins and said, this is the argument and this is the proposal, I was a stranger. But when other Bedouins came in and said, yes, he's telling the truth, wonderful job this, we did it with him in Iraq, they helped me to get recruits, you see. So eventually I raised my 100 men, got my machine guns and trucks, and started work in Transjordan. The last raid we had was in the summer of 1932. I arrived there in the summer of the spring of 1930. So it took a couple of years to completely end all raiding. But after the first 8 months or so, it was almost over.
What was your rank with the Arab Legion when you arrived?
A brigadier. I was merely put into the Arab Legion. As I said, I was a civilian in Iraq for 5 years. But the desert was under military control in Transjordan. And so in order to have power in the desert, they gave me a commission in the Arab Legion, was the army of Transjordan.
What had been your previous highest rank in the army?
Major.
Previously?
British Army, Major.
So this was a tremendous promotion and responsibility.
Well, not in a way, nominally. But I only, with the rank of brigadier, I only commanded 100 men. So it wasn't a very senior position.
I think you were second in command then under Peak, were you?
Yes, but I did only desert. Peak was commanding all the forces of Transjordan, you see.
What was your impression of Peak?
Oh, Peak was a splendid fellow. he, unfortunately, his disability was that he only wrote with great difficulty. I don't mean to say he was illiterate, but he didn't take to writing copiously. And so he never could get across his views to senior people. But he was full of courage and enterprise. Like when he first arrived in Transjordan, the whole place was in chaos. And he had to start from zero, raising police. And he fought two or three little campaigns of his own against the insurgent tribes there. He had no British assistance. So, and they all liked him because he was very frank and open.
What were conditions like in Transjordan when you arrived?
When I arrived, the settled areas were peaceful. You see, the configuration of Transjordan is, on the west, you have a tremendous deep rift, which is the Jordan Valley, and the Dead Sea goes down to several hundred feet below sea level. And then, on the east of the Jordan Valley, a great wall of mountains. And these mountains on their east side gradually peter out into desert. The reason being that all the rains come from the Mediterranean, and the mountains stop the rains. So that on the mountains they get plenty of rain, but the mountains prevent the clouds going further on. So east of the mountains peters out rapidly into desert. So Transjordan consisted of a long strip of mountain from north to south, and east of those, just open desert. The mountains were covered with villages, gardens, vineyards, and so on. But, of course, where it petered out into desert, there were just nomadic tribes. But when I got there, the settled areas along the mountains and the foot of the mountains were well in good order and well policed. There were no sort of open disturbances. But they hadn't attempted the desert at all.
What kind of troops did your Arab Legion men make, whom you recruited in the early 30s?
Well, one gets mixed up with Arab Legion, you see, because all the different forces of Transjordan were called the Arab Legion. Originally, when I was in the desert, I said I had 100 men. They were, of course, not trained for normal military action. They were quite good using their machine guns from their trucks, which is the kind of tactics we used against mounted raiders. Then the other thing we did was, the desert, of course, depends on wells most of the year. Occasionally it rains in winter when you get pools of water in valleys and so on. Most of the year they all depend on wells. So we built a fort on every well with 8 or 10 men in it. The result was the tribes couldn't get water unless they came in under the control of the forts. And that also established not only complete control of the tribes, but friendly relations. Outside our forts, we always pitched a large tent, which was for guests. And the fort behaved like Arabs, that is, any passerby could step off in the guest tent where he would receive a meal and accommodation. That made a sort of friendship and intermixture between the police, who were themselves tribesmen, and the tribes who were outside. So before very long, we and our tribes were enthusiastic cooperators, whereas formerly they had regarded the government as their deadly enemies.
After the last raid had taken place in 1932, what was your main role then?
Well, all sorts of other things began happening in other parts of the world. The first thing we had to do, apart from the raiding over the desert, was that in the extreme north of the deserts of Transjordan, there's an enormous volcanic area entirely strewn with great lava boulders, which is very difficult even to walk over. And this was inhabited by a number of slightly scruffy tribes, nomadic Arab tribes, who bred chiefly sheep, but they moved about on camels. And nobody had ever been able to cope with these people because it's almost impossible to get into these lava fields. So we had quite a job there. We only had trucks, commercial Ford trucks. So what we did was one day I drove up to the beginning of the lava field, got out and started shifting boulders. So then the chaps came by and said, "What's all this?" So I said, "Oh, we're going to make a road through here to take our trucks into the lava." And they joined in all right when they saw me humping the boulders. And gradually, I say it was rather slow, heavy work, we cleared passable tracks all over this lava area. This rather shook these tribes, who'd never been interfered with by any government before. However, we were both friendly and powerful at the same time, if you see what I mean. There wouldn't have been any use trying to be friendly unless you had machine guns. But having the machine guns, you couldn't really make a settlement unless you got friendly. So as we pushed into the lava, clearing our own tracks everywhere, where we saw a tribesman or something, we gave him a cup of coffee and invited him to a drink. Then, of course, we pitched tents at night and they passed by. And eventually we became great friends of these lava tribes. But it took about 2 years, pretty hard work humping boulders, before we got the whole thing going smoothly.
I think this was up on the border with French-controlled Syria, was it not?
Yes,
What was the French reaction to this? What was your relationship with the French at this time?
Well, the French were always... It was a curious situation after the war, because although Britain and France had been friendly, or allies in France, they continued rather jealous of one another in Asia. And the French were a bit suspicious. So then we had to undertake a diplomatic offensive with the French. And I made great friends with a French officer who was controlling the district, also in the lava. Most of the lava was in Syria.
Can you remember his name?
Filliet, yes, F-I-L-L-I-E-T. And he came and stayed with me in Amman. I went and stayed with him and his wife and so on. And so we smoothed that one over quite well and got on quite well with the French. And then the next thing that happened was in 1936, there was an Arab revolt in Palestine against the large numbers of Jewish settlers who were coming in and buying land. And some of the Palestinians who lost their land went up into Syria, where they formed into gangs and came down with the object of shooting the place up in Palestine. This has been going on for 40 years, of course. However, the easiest way for them to get into Palestine, which was still a British mandate, was by coming through Transjordan, which was also a British mandate. So, of course, the British pressed the Jordan government to prevent these gangs from crossing into Palestine and shooting people up. And the gangs were very well armed. So at one stage, when a large influx of gangs came over, the Jordan government ordered me to take the desert police into the settled areas of northern Jordan to stop these gangs of terrorists going through. We had a little schmozzle there too. Well, then the Arab rebellion was suppressed in Jordan, in Palestine. And then things began to pile up. Hitler was getting very menacing and so on, and the world situation became increasingly threatening. So I was given the authority to increase from 100 to, I think, 350 armed police, armed desert police. And that was quite a job, too. And with one thing and another, that we were extremely busy until the Second World War began. Just before the Second World War, a peak retired, and I became commander of the whole Arab Legion, that is, all the armed forces in Transjordan, of which the desert was only a comparatively small number. There were about 1,000 men, I think, in Jordan, in the settled areas of Transjordan, and 350 machine gun desert police.